It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 220, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, lots of AI. Software is art. iPad conundrum.
Hey, Gary. Welcome back to another week.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's going well. It's actually sunny here for a change. It's nice. Were you able to see the aurora?
You know, I could have. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you take a risk. If I had gone and driven about an hour north of the city on Friday night, plenty of pictures from just north of Denver of it looking beautiful, and even more beautiful just 2 hours north in Wyoming. But, you know, it was like a risk. It was like there were clouds around, you know, all that kind of thing. Do I really want to stay up really late and try this? And I opted not to, because I have seen the aurora plenty. I've seen it in Alaska. I've seen it in Iceland.
Oh, that's right. You've been to the appropriate places, of course.
Yeah. So if I had not seen the aurora up to this point, I would have been chasing it, no doubt. So for me, the biggest thing that changed that night was that instead of being somewhat unique, I'm now less so, because so many more people, so many more Americans in particular, have now seen the aurora with their own eyes. Did you get to see it?
I did not.
Oh.
I've actually still never seen the real aurora. There was one night many years ago where apparently the sky to our north was just sort of green, but it didn't really have any of the wavy features that I see in all the pictures. No, as it turns out, we ended up going to bed, and our neighbor actually did stay out. And I think between like midnight and 1 a.m. here, they were able to see it quite nicely.
Oh, the
next night, they looked again, and it didn't come up. And then the third night, you know, there was nothing. So, but nope, I'm still an Aurora Borealis virgin. I'm going to have to do something like go to Iceland. Use it as an excuse to go to Iceland.
It's a good excuse to go to Iceland or Alaska, both beautiful places to visit and get a chance to see that. The advantage of Iceland, I think, is you can go at a more reasonable, like, you know, Alaska, the nice times to visit for all the other reasons of it to visit Alaska are when it's daylight almost all the time.
Right.
Whereas Iceland, I think you've got more opportunities in, you know, the non-summer months to enjoy it. But you should definitely go and check it out, make it a party, especially, you know, it's hard to predict, of course, but there are times a year, you know, where it's better. And this was a weird, very weird event. And I have to say, there were a lot of people that before this kept saying, you know, if we ever get some solar flares, you know, some really big disturbances coming our way, all of our technology is in a lot of trouble, you know, doomsayers and all that.
Yeah, I keep hearing
and
that.
That didn't happen.
Well, apparently there was some GPS interruption
in some places,
but nothing major. Yeah.
Most normal people didn't even notice, you know, whereas some people were like, oh, if that ever happens, like, what do you
all
see? You know, it's going to be the apocalypse.
Yeah.
So that's good to know that our systems are as robust as they're supposed to be.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So lots of AI goings on this week.
Yeah, I mean, we had two events this week, or they're still ongoing, of course. I think, you know, Google I.O., which is all their big announcements that they do once a year, is this week. But OpenAI is kind of like, they're also doing their big announcements. And in doing so, they're almost setting themselves up as rivals. You know, the tech industry is like a bunch of sports teams, really. There's multiple rivalries going on in different directions, you know, all coming off the original, you know, well, I guess originally there was like the Apple-IBM rivalry, and then the Apple-Microsoft one. And, you know, well, a lot of them do involve Apple, actually. But, you know, OpenAI really wants to set up, it seems like, an OpenAI versus Google one in the AI space. And this week certainly set the stage for it, because Google announced a bunch of AI advancements and OpenAI came out with their advancements at the same time. And a lot of them overlapped, which really focused people on these are the two big names. That's not necessarily true. There are tons of other names in the space, but these are, you know, I don't know. It kind of feels like, at least moving from this week on, it's, you know, Gemini versus ChatGPT, and various other parts for each company. And OpenAI had an interesting, you know, big like announcement, which was, you know, very like, it was like half living room, half meeting space kind of presentation. I don't know if you watched any of it.
I did not.
It's, you know, tech tech announcements have gotten so weird because it used to be that like the big announcements were done at conferences like CES or the like. And you would have like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or somebody getting up in front of a massive audience and doing a presentation, right? And the audience would be like half people that were fanboys and half people that were like there for other reasons. And you'd be trying to impress them. And it was like a big deal. And now everybody's doing these pre-recorded or like very small audience live things. Anyway, so this was like it was in a living room that somebody happened to have a stage up front. obviously it was all designed for it. Right. And they showed off a bunch of new stuff. And the new stuff they showed was really very impressive. Like, for instance, they showed off a version of ChatGPT that it's this new version they have now. You can actually use it called GPT-4o, with right. O being a lowercase letter O.
Right.
Because it's not – the name isn't confusing enough already.
Right.
and the thing is, it's like what they showed was more than just the text part, which we can all use now. It was like this whole voice assistant thing, which they have – already in the apps, but it's kind of the older generation. This new one showed a lot of emotion,
right?
Like laughing and giggling between what, you know, was said. You could interrupt it and it handles interruption. So it feels more like you're talking to somebody rather than having it to wait, you know, having to wait for it to finish its whole little thing. And then you ask the next thing, you can just interrupt it right in the middle. It seemed to be able to be fine with talking to multiple people in the room too. And it also, it showed more personality than ChatGPT or Gemini have now. Also a lot of use of like the camera. There was one really impressive, demo that I'm going to include a link. I think you can, if you just go to OpenAI's YouTube page, they have like all of these little
right.
things just there
right.
and little bite-sized videos. And one of them is, you know, a guy asking for help with, like, do I look okay for my job interview? So it's using the camera on the iPhone. And ChatGPT in real time, without any delay, was commenting on the guy's appearance from looking at the guy in the camera. And it was really kind of impressive. And then another two other demos featured, like, homework help kind of thing, where the camera is actually looking at what you're writing on the paper and coming up with, you know, suggestions and teaching you how to do things. And it just, it felt a lot zippier. It felt a lot more like you're talking to somebody than, you know, a call and response kind of thing with the current ChatGPT. And anyway, it's impressive. And I think for me, the big thing was that it's just the forward movement of it all. Like, sure. It's just getting a little bit better all the time. And so the idea that, oh, they came up with this large language model idea, but it's kind of stuck. This is what it does. The next advancement is going to have to take some sort of revolution. Seems like maybe that's not the case now. Like, large language models can constantly be improved bit by bit.
Right.
To do, you know, more and more to and get to better and better things. And Google's stuff also talked about much more incorporation into the Android operating system, having it there as an assistant in lots of different ways. You know, having it in Google Work apps, also in Chrome, the Chrome browser, also in Android, and available throughout various apps, with the idea that it can kind of see what you're doing, and
right.
You know, you don't have to tell. It's not blind like ChatGPT. GPT seems blind now. You're working on some code and you go to it and it has no idea what you're going to ask it, what you're doing. And you have to like, here's some code, here's what I want, you know, and you tell it this stuff. Now things seem to be moving towards like it can see stuff. As a matter of fact, they demoed a Mac app, and that's something interesting I want to get to in a minute. That's a Mac app. Okay. But the Mac app is like a little assistant on your Mac. And it could see what you're working on. You give it permission and all that to look at what you're working on. But it could see what you're doing. And you could ask it questions. And you don't have to feed it the code or tell it what you're looking at or anything. Like, it showed, like, you had a graph on the screen. And you could ask it questions about the graph. And it was like another person that was looking at the graph and could tell you things that were going on and, you know, summarize it for you and stuff, which is really interesting because, you know, it just feels like, wow, that could be really be, I don't know, a whole step forward. And like I said, this is a Mac app. So they have an iOS app, which I didn't really think too much about. Like, okay, they've got one for iOS. Makes sense. It's a big, almost dominant platform. I mean, Android's neck and neck with it. Right. But now a Mac app, but no Windows app.
Yes. Tell me about it.
they said that, oh, Windows will have a Windows app. It'll be coming at some point.
Later this Mac app, year is the phrase, yeah. Yes.
The Mac app is here now. I have it. Now, I don't have access to use it. When I try to log in, it says I'm not yet, my account hasn't been selected yet as one that's available, you know, that I can use it for.
Okay.
But I have the paid account, so it'll be rolling out to me first in the next few weeks, right? So every day, I guess I'm just going to check. But the interesting thing is, of course, there's all these other rumors of Apple being in bed with OpenAI. Now suddenly they come out with a Mac app, only promising a Windows app in the future, and it seems to be a little bit integrated, which makes me think that there's already stuff going on. Plus, of course, their demo featured lots of iPhones and Macs, which was really interesting. It's like it feels like something, some contracts have been signed in the background that we just don't know about at this point.
I wonder, I thought about this too, because when you were talking about the AI app watching what you're doing in other apps on your machine. That's the direction I understand that Microsoft's own Copilot is going in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if either, I don't know if it's a conflict or a prioritization thing, but you know, Windows will have Copilot to do all this stuff, which, you know, builds in pieces of ChatGPT as well.
Yeah.
Or maybe someday we'll just suddenly find out that, you know, the Apple app and the Windows app for ChatGPT is Copilot.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've read some things where people have pointed out there are already big companies that are privately using ChatGPT for their own in-house apps, and it's really no different than what Microsoft and maybe Apple are doing. You know, ChatGPT could just be playing for both. You know. Right. They've got here, you know, a deal with both companies. I don't know. It's really interesting. One note about the personality is, you know, the voice in the demos sounds an awful lot like Scarlett Johansson, which of course brings up, you know, the movie Her,
right,
where the AI was voiced by Scarlett Johansson. And a lot of it really gives those vibes to the point of so many people commenting on the fact that, boy, it really almost seems like it's there now. I mean, it's not. Obviously, in that movie, there was a lot more about, I don't know, an entity that you were talking to. Whereas this feels like it might be, I don't know, the intelligence without the entity. You know, you can ask questions and get good answers and get help in doing things. But maybe it doesn't feel like there's actually another person there, which would be fine. You know, I think a lot of science fiction, the entity part of AI is kind of the unwanted side effect, right? we want computers to be able to help us do things, but we don't necessarily want them to suddenly become sentient and want to do things on their own.
It's interesting because I forget. Are you watching Star Trek Discovery?
No, not yet. I'll get there.
Okay, good. Minor spoiler for that then. You know, in all of the Star Trek series that we're familiar with, there's a computer, right?
Yeah.
A computer, and you just talk to it and it does things. And it's kind of sort of seems like variations of that are where we are with OpenAI still. There's a lot of knowledge, a lot of language processing, but not a lot of I don't even want to say intelligence, but there is no entity, as you put it.
Yeah.
However, I forget if it's season two or three, there will be an entity in Star Trek Discovery. And it just becomes another useful thing on the ship. It's not its creation is a dramatic story, right? There's a lot of risk, but once it's in place, it's actually just another, almost another, just another crewman.
But isn't that in,
questions.
I don't know where it falls out on the timeline, but in Next Generation, of course, there's Data.
Yes.
So, you know,
no,
an
the
entity
Discovery,
right there.
Again, minor spoiler, Discovery leaps forward about a 900 years, I think.
Oh, okay. So it's after Next Generation.
Oh, well after, yes.
Well after, but yeah.
In fact, they actually refer explicitly to historical figures like Picard.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it is interesting. I did just rewatch the entire original series, and the computer AI isn't used very much.
Right.
Probably only in a handful of episodes, but it definitely is there.
Yep.
Like, it definitely, there's one episode in particular where it comes into play as part of the plot. The other times it's just there as a minor thing that usually
that
Kirk talks to and asks for a few things, or Spock is playing chess against.
M5, I think, is the one where they turn over control of the ship to the computer, to a new version of the computer, and hilarity ensues.
So yeah, there's a lot of, I don't know, it just feels like a lot of excitement in AI this week, and we've got next month is Apple's big worldwide developer conference event, which is expected to be heavily about AI. And there was actually, I don't want to jump to a later story, but in Apple's event last week, which was about iPads, they actually teased some AI by saying, okay, there's these new processors in these iPads. We'll talk about that later. But they mentioned two updates to two apps, Final Cut Pro and Logic Pro, and they showed two new features of each, both using AI, but not this kind of AI, not chatty AI.
Right.
In Final Cut, they showed basically separate an object or subject really from the foreground using AI.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just lifting the subject off of a picture, you can actually take a video and say, I just want this person. And it gets rid of the whole rest of it throughout the entire video. So, and that's AI. And then in Logic, it had the instrument separation thing where you could take a track and it's just a recorded track and say, oh, break that down into drums, vocals, guitar, and bass. And then
it is kind of interesting because there's so much more to AI than just something you chat with.
Yes.
The stuff that you just mentioned in Final Cut, I don't know how it relates, but just this morning, literally, somebody sent me a video for a project and they shot it in disappointingly low resolution, right?
Yeah.
But as it turns out, I've got an app from Topaz Video AI, and it does intelligent upscaling. And it also changed it from 15 to 30 FPS, which made for a much easier to view video. So that kind of stuff is also very much part of the mix. I've played with ChatGPT 4.0. I don't know how we're going to keep all this straight.
Yeah.
It goes back to the OS X, OS 10 debate. It's funny, I haven't done a lot with it, but I will say that it absolutely feels faster. And in fact, it feels faster both in textual responses and in image generation, which is one of the things that I use it for a lot. The interface to DALL-E, I don't know if DALL-E itself is faster or something else is faster, but it just seems to be returning the images I ask for a little bit more quickly. And I did play with the Android app some. I actually don't know where that is on the scale, but I, had a conversation with it. Now, I've had a conversation with it before, and it was very much stock, I don't want to say monotone, but definitely, sort of a flat response voice. Whereas the discussion I had with it this morning, same thing, same thing you were mentioning earlier, that the voice, it wasn't Scarlett Johansson, but it was definitely more animated, which I thought was interesting, almost a little bit too much. And I don't know if that's a dial you can tweak or not, but I just thought it was interesting that absolutely they're moving in that way too. Supposedly, I've not done this, but supposedly you could just leave it running in this discussion mode and just talk to it like somebody's else in your room. So,
I know I do want to try that once I get the Mac app. I want to, it's one of those tools. I think it's going to be hard to, retrain your brain. Like my brain says, be sit in my office, be quiet, and click and type, And so having this other, having the ability to actually talk, and it's going to be interesting too to see if Apple lets it do things, because I think that could be fascinating. Apple already has this voice control stuff set on the Mac, and you could turn that on, and you could, I could actually control everything by speaking commands. Choose this menu item, click here, do all this, And it would be interesting if there was a path where I could ask ChatGPT to do something, open a browser window, go to this web page, fill out this form, look for an article on this page about this, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's got all sorts of possibilities. But the thing is that all this stuff is very possible right now. I mean, I can see it. It's just whether or not it works well enough. Apple's got to decide, and Microsoft's got to decide too. Google's got to decide with Android. It's like, does it work often enough to just give it to people? Like, if you ask it to do some things, will it get it right 99% of the time? And is that enough for it to allow people to do it? Or is it like, no, it's going to mess up too often and people will get frustrated. Let's make it better first.
The problem I have with the conversation is I said, okay, great. I should have a conversation. I should talk to it and see how it does. I can't think of anything to talk about. It's like
Well,
you
yeah,
said,
that's
I'm busy typing, and if I do something, it's on the computer. I'm typing and reading and so forth. I'm just quiet here by myself. But when it comes time to just sort of have a random, spontaneous conversation with this artificial intelligence, it's like, what do I say?
Yeah, I mean, because there's, we already do. I assume you have an inner dialogue,
Yes.
like I do. Not everybody does. So, but I think part of it is that we already kind of do stuff like that. Like if we could really deconstruct the lightning fast inner dialogue, it's like, if you're, if I'm laying something out in like a desktop publishing program. I get, oh, should I put a line here? Yeah, maybe I should make it thicker. Oh, should I change the color? What color would be best? Red, green, blue? Your mind kind of thinks like that. And if I could somehow verbalize that, or at least some of it, and, instead of thinking, oh, what color goes best here? If I could actually say that out loud, I wonder what color this line should be. And maybe ChatGPT says, well, based on the rest of the colors for this document, I would suggest a light orange. So that would be really interesting. I also there's some musical stuff too. We were talking about the emotion. Some of the demos, they asked for more emotion or more sarcasm. There was one where they asked it to be very sarcastic, and it did. And another one where they asked it to sing, and it just started just doing a sing-songy thing. And then there was another one where they actually asked it to sing, but with two voices. At like a higher voice and like a low voice, and to harmonize. And kept inter and the woman doing the demo kept interrupting it and say, now harm do a little faster, get more harmony in there. And it just and two voices at the same time. It was it just got it to sing, which was really kind of fascinating. There's a lot of music stuff going on too, with there's so many different music AI things I was playing with this week. Nothing that really stands out, but lots of things that will make a song based on a description. And we're talking instruments, vocals, everything. And it's kind of garbage, but not that bad. It's like kind of like garbage, but better than I could do because I'm not a musician.
Yes, exactly. I can relate to that one. Yes.
So yeah, I guess that's the best way to describe, which is also describes a lot of the artwork you get from DALL-E and all,
There's that, but that's
garbage,
also when you
but
think
I
about
can't
it,
do it.
the text stuff, even it was garbage, right? And now it's not. I mean, depending on who you ask, of course, but it's improving. And I think the exact same thing is going to happen to both images and music.
Well, remember when ChatGPT was first released, We both did an experiment where we asked it to generate biographies
Oh,
for
yeah.
each of us and how poorly it did in terms of like getting some of the facts right. And I've recently, I just reran that and no errors, much better writing, and it's even longer. So it's actually including even more information. But there was nothing wrong with that. It was perfect. I mean, you know, none of the ridiculous stuff that it kind of made up about me. So things are moving forward with
I'm
that.
in the, oh, I got a very short, I asked ChatGPT for, ooh, who is Leo A. Notenboom? This is Leo A. Notenboom is a technology enthusiast and an expert who provides technical support to average consumers, primarily focusing on Microsoft Windows, computers, and the internet. He's based in Seattle, close enough. And he has an extensive background in technology, having worked at Microsoft for 18 years. For over 20 years, he's been answering questions and providing help through the website Ask Leo, with it, which is a link. That's spot on. That is a one paragraph, absolutely. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I would even expect to see at the bottom of an article or something, right? Published in a magazine where, you know, they're
Sure,
trying to
that would
brief a
be
real
great.
brief bio of the author.
But imagine that, imagine you've got an earpiece in and you're at a fancy party
Who is this guy?
and yes, and you tell ChatGPT, hey, when I meet somebody, when somebody introduces themselves to me, give me a short two paragraph bio in my ear.
Right.
And you just hear that. And I mean, that's kind of the direction that we want to head in, I guess. I mean, if you want that,
That is pretty funny. I like that idea,
pretty
especially
cool.
for those of us who just don't handle those situations very well natively.
Actually, come to think of it, based on the other demo I saw, you don't even have to have that. It could just do it based on the camera, you know, right? So you've got one of that AI pin. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So you've got that or something similar, and it just, as you go up to somebody, it recognizes who they are and says, "This is Gary Rosenzweig. He's the host and producer of MacMost.com," which produce, you know, and it's just in your ear, and maybe you even have a little signal, you know, tap your ring finger to your palm. And it will shut up, or tap your pinky to your palm, and it will continue on and give you more information.
I will tell you that while we were talking, I fired up the app on my phone, and it also does images, right? It'll do image recognition and describe things and so forth. I took a photo of your photo in Zoom, and I asked it, "Who might this be?" And the response was disappointing. It was,
It said disappointing.
I'm sorry, I can't identify people in photos."
Not there yet.
Basically, I need to ask the person who sent me the photo who that is. So
Well,
that's
but
funny.
it's getting there because certainly our, you know, Google Photos and My Photos app, you know, the Mac Photos app, and
Oh yeah, they're doing it.
that identifies people. Oh, there was something in the Google I/O about this.
Yes.
So you can ask. There's a like a photo AI or something, or was it chat photo? I forget what they called it, but there was one feature that they touted for using Gemini with the Google Photos apps, and that was to be able to search. And the demo they did was, oh, what's my license plate number? You know, a typical
Yes.
thing. Somebody asks you your license plate number, it's like, I don't know, and so asking that, it looked through the person's pictures, correctly identified which car was actually theirs based on other information, like the location of the car and how often it was close proximity to them, found a
Funny.
picture that included the license plate number, read the license plate number to them, and showed the picture for confirmation. Here's the picture I got it from, so you can look at it to make sure I got it right. And the whole idea was it could use your photo library as kind of a database of stuff. And just the other day I did this. I needed to know when we were someplace. And my wife's like, when we were here. I was like, I don't know, but if I look for a photo in that location, I'll find it. But presumably, if I had an AI hooked up to it like that, I could just say, when was I in Tokyo? And it would
Right.
look at my photos and said, you were in Tokyo in 2014 and 2017,
That's
because
funny.
that's what my photos show. Or maybe I could say, what was the name of that garden, the gardens I visited That one time I was in Tokyo, and it could say, according to your pictures, you went to this guy, so some of
And
it's there.
actually, with Google, I don't know if you've got Google's location tracking, but certainly on Android, it would also be able to pull in the map history, the location history you've got. So,
A lot of this can be tied in together. And this is where the integration comes. Because, ChatGPT is out there by itself. Like OpenAI didn't have like any of this. But integrating with Microsoft, with Google, and well, not with Google, integrating with Microsoft and Apple gives it, it's combining the AI with the date, your personal data, to allow you to get information about yourself. And then Google has that, all in one vertical there. They've got the AI and the data. So I
it's interesting.
wonder, yeah,
Go ahead.
go ahead.
Well, I was just to say there's a player that we keep not mentioning that I'm just shocked about. And that's Amazon. I keep expecting my Echo devices to suddenly, I mean, they're like a perfect device for everything we've been talking about. And there's just no hints, no rumors, no nothing.
Maybe they're waiting to leapfrog everybody, or maybe they just want to use AWS as the back end for everything and just profit that way.
They certainly do have some large language model stuff in AWS. I just they don't seem to be using it. I just don't know. It's just that part is disappointing. Now, with that being said, I don't know if Google is doing anything with their equivalent device, the Google Home, I think it is, or whatever that little its little speaker thingy is. And again, that seems like such an opportunity for the kind of technologies we've been talking about.
And that's one of the things that, also people are wondering still, just speculating. Apple's got Siri, which is not AI, it's just a voice assistant. Will Apple basically create Siri 2 that is AI, using all of this? Or are they going to do something? Are they going to separate this from Siri? Siri's got a ton of name recognition, but it's not all good. People make jokes about how bad Siri can be sometimes for getting things done. But Apple's just the sort of company that could turn that around on a dime. You know what I mean? It's like you're one day you're making jokes about Siri, and then they release like Siri powered by OpenAI, and that just disappears. And suddenly Siri is like the AI to have. So,
It's making jokes about you.
yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to head off in a slightly philosophical direction because this is something that it's not about any specific AI or AI technology or AI development, but it is a topic that's come up a lot over, I'll just say, the last 18 months since the initial release of ChatGPT. I keep hearing that AI is going to be the death of computer programming, in that AI certainly has been shown to be able to generate some really interesting code, some really interesting snippets, solutions to described problems, as opposed to having a person actually sit down and laboriously write the code to solve a certain problem. And that got me to thinking that the answer is both yes and no, in my opinion. Computer programming will never go away. But when you think about it, it has transformed itself in multiple different ways over the course of the computer's existence. I mean, originally, a programmer was somebody who was flipping switch in front of an old, mainframe's control panel. And then they became somebody who, wrote software in assembly language. Then they became somebody who wrote, actually, there's an intermediate step, right? Machine code came first. Then they made it easier for humans to interact with by creating assembly language. And then they came up with higher level languages. Higher level languages have given way to other higher level languages that are more capable, perhaps more focused on the kind of tasks we actually use them with. To me, if AI is going to take over or change or have an impact on how computer software is written, it's not going to be that there won't be any humans involved, I think it'll be very much like the we've talked about on a lot of things right now. One of the hottest jobs is a prompt engineer. When you think about it, that's what that's a programmer, right? You're telling your AI what to do. It's very possible that the concept of programming might change, the concept of coding might change, but there will always still be people who are involved in deciding what should be done and how it should be done. I don't know. Came up to me the other day, just because, like I said, I rebel at this concept of programming being dead. It's not dead. It's just changing.
Yep. Yeah. No. I as somebody who is programming pretty heavily using ChatGPT, it is to me it feels more like it's documentation on steroids than it does actually doing it for me. Like, I'm still making the decisions on the features. I'm still making the decisions on how it works, but I'm not getting, it's not the nitty gritty. And like when I started programming, I was doing the early programming language. So stuff like Basic, Pascal, Fortran, COBOL was like, it was that. And there was this feeling when I was doing it that assembly was, if you wanted performance out of something like a Apple II computer or whatever, you wanted to go and write assembly code. But you still had to assemble it. But that was like the closest you can get to doing like raw code. I was up one level with doing programming languages.
Sure.
But that the programming languages have evolved, and a lot of programming languages today are interpreted. So they actually are interpreted at runtime. Whereas when I was working with things like, say, Pascal or Fortran in those early days, it was compiling, and I was basically getting machine code out of it, but it wasn't as optimized as if I wrote assembly code to go to machine code. And now it's not even compiling. It's just interpreting it on the fly, which makes it more versatile. And you could do some really interesting things, but you're another level above. Now, when we talk about like having AI help me program, I almost feel like it's getting to the point where there is this other shell forming where I'm doing the prompts and maybe I'm assembling the pieces, but I'm not going to bother myself with like writing the raw, you know, in this case, Swift code, you know, in the near future.
What's the syntax for a for loop in this language I happen to be using? I forget.
Swift has some amazing for loop syntax, all sorts of variations that as a programmer, you look at it and say, oh, that's beautiful. Look at that. Oh, I can go backwards in the numbers from this to this, and I can have it. I can have other things increment at the same time in different directions. It's really cool stuff. But then trying to remember it all.
Right.
You know, to get the exact syntax right. Is that two dots or three dots? I can't remember. Yep. Just ask ChatGPT. I just need a for loop that's going to iterate like this from here to, you know, here to here. And it spits it out. I'm like, oh, yeah. I could have written that, but it was easier to ask ChatGPT to write it for me.
Yep.
And I copy and paste. And I move on with it.
One of the things we're relying on is the continued increase in processing power, because you touched on it earlier. When I started as well, especially at Microsoft, our early days, the software we were writing was absolutely in assembly language. And that was not because it was such an efficient language. It's because we needed to eke out every possible bit of performance that we could. We were making the decision between assembly language instructions because this one is one clock cycle less than that one, kind of stuff. And those kinds of things at that time added up. We definitely improved the compilers so that they would do a better job of optimization, so that they would recognize things, you know, certain constructs that they could implement or translate into machine code in a certain way that was more efficient. But eventually, the bottom line is that using a high-level language, any high-level language, even if it's compiled, is less efficient than writing assembly language. And I do believe that in the long run, using AI to write code will probably be less efficient, or the result will be less efficient than writing that code by hand in a high-level language. The process will be more efficient, right? We can produce a lot more software with many more features, yada, yada. If we're using a higher level language than we can if we were still trying to do everything in assembly language. I think about it occasionally because, to take some of the major apps that we run these days, if they had been written and were still written in an assembly language, they would be, to our current eyes, unbelievably fast, right? Just because they were written in this lower level language and much more finely tuned. But instead, we've got larger applications with more features, more applications that have been easier to design and develop because we're using higher level languages. Mm-hmm. I suspect that this is just another higher level language that we're thinking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's both something you could use to program and it's the program itself. Like, for instance, I could make, if I needed an app to do something with, calculations, several calculations, I need to feed all these numbers in and get this result. I want an app to do that for me. I could use AI to help me write that app, but I could also just use AI to calculate that for me. I could just feed it those numbers and say, here, let me explain what I want you to do. And it does it. And then I could say, okay, remember that. And because every month I need to rerun this. So I could just skip over making an app and have this actually be the app.
Right.
It's blurring that line.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And a related question, something else I was thinking about, because somebody said it isn't. And I have believed strongly for a very long time that software can be art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that in the sense that there are, when you're solving a problem, there are multiple ways to solve a specific problem. Some ways are ugly, some ways are elegant and efficient, and sometimes the code itself is even beautiful to look at. I don't remember the context anymore, but they were claiming that, it's not art. It's just something. It's just a thing. And I disagree with that so strongly. I remember many years ago while I was at Microsoft working on some piece of code I was particularly proud of. The thought had occurred to me, this is more than just a solution. This is more than just software. This is actually art. And I was proud of whatever it was I had generated at the time. What do you think?
I completely agree with you. I've always said that programming is an art form, just like writing is an art form, or painting or anything like that. There are mechanical processes to it and things you need to learn and skills and all sorts of stuff, but it is also an art form. I always feel like that when I'm programming. I do feel like I'm creating art. And the interesting thing is this AI might be proving this, because it's really basically the same process for it to create, like for DALL-E to create a piece of a digital two-dimensional painting, as it is for it to code. Like the basis for it is part of the same engine. And of course, we should always know that because we're creating the same things out of human brains. Both paintings and computer code.
Yep. Anyway, so yes, software is art, damn it.
Yep, definitely. So that does mean that, of course, that even if AI is completely capable of creating any computer code needed, it doesn't mean that we'll stop coding. Just as like DALL-E does not mean that eventually people will stop painting, because there's a joy in painting, and there's sometimes some sort of serendipitous creativity that comes out of doing it yourself.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting because I think a lot of people will say that, the AI generated stuff, be it images or words or whatever, it lacks a certain humanity. It lacks a certain something that only a real person would be able to imbue in their results. And I tend to agree with that to a point, but I think that the line between what is and what is not, humanity in that sense, when expressed in art, is probably going to get blurrier and thinner at the same time. The question is, does it matter? Obviously it's going to matter to the writers that their stuff is their stuff. It's their heart and their soul putting out whatever they're putting out. That AI could generate something similar. Does it really matter? I don't know. It depends on what you're looking at your art, what purpose you're looking your art to serve.
Yeah. I mean, it may just come down to, you know, programmers don't have to create those login pages anymore. You know, the boring stuff. The boring stuff could be done by an AI, and then the human programmers can choose to do the fun, creative, interesting stuff. So,
Apparently, I don't have to write my own bio anymore. So there we
oh,
go.
well, there you go. Yeah, well, that is true. It's like, I didn't even think of that. Like the next time I'm asked for a bio, and for some reason the one I have doesn't work. Like, you know, I've got like a bio that's one paragraph. If somebody says, I need a one paragraph bio of you. And if somebody says, I need a longer bio, I've got one that's five paragraphs. So if somebody said, I need a three paragraph bio of you, I don't have it. I don't need to write it anymore. I could just ask ChatGPT to give me a three paragraph bio of me.
There you go. So,
Cool.
in other news, you
Yes.
alluded to this earlier. Do I
Yeah.
need to go out and buy another iPad?
Well, that's the big question. So Apple did something really weird last week, and they had new announcements. Nothing weird about that. They came out with the new iPads. Nothing weird about that. It was all due. But the weird thing is the top level ones, the iPad Pros, they came out with those, and they have the Apple M4 processor in them. They hadn't released the M4 processor for anything else yet. So the top level Mac now has an M3 processor, but there are two iPads in existence that actually have a processor that's one generation ahead of anything in a Mac, which is strange. Apple's never quite done that before. And what it's really done is it's heated up the debate or reignited the debate is can you use an iPad to replace your MacBook, right? And it is an interesting question because you know you have to get an iPad and you get the Magic Keyboard, which is expensive. I think it's like $300 or $350. It's more than a keyboard. It's a keyboard, it's a trackpad, it's a stand, but it basically turns an iPad into a laptop. When you have the Magic trackpad or the Magic Keyboard attached, it looks like a really thin laptop.
Yep, I've seen them. Yep.
Yeah, and there are certainly people that do things like they write and they surf the web and do research. They answer their email, all of that. Certain tasks that you don't need a MacBook. You can do it on the iPad. And there are many people that already made that transition. But this kind of reignites it. I guess you know, people that thought an iPad could do it all for them, they switched over. Now, you know, it was kind of static. And now it's like a new set of people are saying, oh, wow, now there's such a powerful processor in the iPad. Maybe I should be making the switch. And they do show apps like Final Cut Pro, for instance, doing cool things on the iPad with this powerful processor. It's very strange that Apple did this. Apple's got like, it's hard to tell what the top processor is now that Apple produces because the M3 line. They never came out with an ultra chip. There are four levels, just the standard. So, like the M2, then the Pro, the M2 Pro, for instance, which basically doubles the number of cores. Then the Max, which goes the next step up. So, the M2 Max. And then the Ultra, which is actually two Max chips together. So, double everything. But they did that for the M2 line. The M3 line, they came out with the M3, the M3 Pro, the M3 Max. And they never came out with the M3 Ultra. And then now they jump to the M4, but they only have the M4. There's no M4 Pro, there's no M4 Max. Those will probably be in future Macs, not iPads. So if you wanted the best processor, what do you get? Because the M4 is the newest, but it's just the base level. The M2 Max has a ton of cores. It's got 12 CPU cores, 30 up to 38 GPU cores, and 16 neural processing units in it. It's a beast, and you can go and claim that, yeah, the M2 Max is faster than the. Sorry, I was reading the M2 Max stuff, not the M3 Max. The M3 Max is actually 12. Oh no, yeah, 16 CPU cores, 40 GPU cores. Oh, I guess it's the same. And 16 MPU. So it's the same, but you're running a little bit at a little faster clock speed. The M2, though, goes to the Ultra, and that has 24 CPU cores. This
Right.
is the maximum. 24 CPU cores, 76 GPU cores, and 32 NPU cores. So that is so many more cores than the M4 that you got to think that the top one might still be the M2 Ultra. The next one might be the M3 Max, and the M4 is actually below those two. But it's hard to compare because when you're talking about core multipliers, you're dependent on, like, is the app using all these cores?
Exactly.
So yeah, it's interesting. It's hard to figure out like what the top is.
Do we have a sense for power consumption? Because I wonder if the M4 Basic is probably, you know, going to use less power than either the
Ultra. I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. No, they definitely.
And that's why it makes sense for the iPad at least.
Well, I mean, it's yeah, I mean, one of the big things is, you know, it goes down to 3 nanometers for the circuitry, so shorter distances with everything, more efficient. You know, the efficiency cores are used more efficiently and all that. So yeah, there's probably a lot going on there. It's really hard to judge, but it has definitely gotten people talking about, like, sure, I need a new MacBook and a new iPad, you know, a new MacBook or a new iPad. And now I'm leaning towards the iPad. And when you look at price, it's interesting because the iPad with, you know, with the keyboard and the pencil pretty much equal the price of a decent, you know, MacBook Air. But the screen is fantastic on the new iPad, even though it's smaller than the MacBook Air. So you got a smaller screen, but, you know, more contrast and brightness and all that stuff. So if you're like into art, you know, if you're doing art, for instance, you've got the Apple Pencil advantage and you've got the screen advantage with the iPad. But if you're not doing that, if you're like, oh, I'm a writer, maybe I should get an iPad. Well, actually, the screen on the MacBook Air is bigger, so you could see more, and it includes the keyboard and all that stuff. You're not getting that extra. I don't know. It's a really hard thing. I'm sure Apple is happy as can be that they've got people wrapped up in this indecision between two Apple products, because that's where you want to be as a company, right? You don't want people deciding between your product and another company's product. You want people deciding between two of your products.
Yep. You want to compete against yourself.
You want to compete against yourself. Yes. And they're so doing that now. It's really cool. I think I'm really, maybe because so many years of working in a windowed operating system, I just cannot get the productivity out of a tablet, you know, operating system where it's, you know, the whole screen is taken up by one thing. Right. And it's touchscreen and all this, and it's not, you know, the mouse or trackpad is the primary thing. I don't know. I mean, I like a big screen. I mean, right now, I don't even know how big a screen I'm working with in my Apple Vision Pro. It's probably equivalent to 50 to 60 inch screen is what I work with every day.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So the idea of going down to an iPad that is 11 inches, you know, just, it's like, I don't like that. But if I was a writer and like I just had to write and that was my primary craft of, you know, words, and I had to produce a certain amount of words, articles, writing a book, whatever it was, boy, it looks like a beautiful way to do it using an iPad.
Especially if you were mobile, if that was your modus operandi, to just be mobile. I mean, laptops, obviously, you know, MacBook Air, fine machine for traveling and so forth. But, you know, an iPad just seems just a little bit more portable, a little bit more convenient. I don't know. It's
multimodal too, because so with a MacBook, you're always basically screen, keyboard, trackpad. That's the mode you're in. With an iPad, with everything, you've got your just the iPad and a touchscreen. You know, sit back, watch Netflix, like that. Right. You've got, I want to do something. You know, I'm going to draw. So I add the Apple Pencil to it. Take that out the Apple Pencil, and it's still a tablet, and it's just the tablet and the pencil. Okay, now I want to get some work done that needs a keyboard. Now I hook it up to the Magic Trackpad. So you've got these three different modes that you could be in, which you know is really interesting. So anyway,
are you going to get one?
Probably not. Based on my experience with the last generation, when I went and bought the big iPad Pro and I just wasn't using it.
Okay.
I just, you know, Xcode is still just a Mac thing. I spend a lot of time in that. I'm doing tutorials that obviously have to be done on the Mac, and my editing software ScreenFlow is just on the Mac. So I, you know, right now I just don't see it being worth it for me. I would just end up, you know, watching Netflix and TikTok on it. Which I could do perfectly fine on an iPad mini, which is what I use as an iPad right now. I don't know. It's one of those things. It's like when I look at some of these really cool digital cameras, I'm like, oh, I want that. But what would I use it for? It's like, oh, these iPads are really sweet. I would love to have one, but it would sit there. So.
Anyway, it definitely looks like a cool device. And in fact, I think the other more promising part about this is the M4 processor and what it bodes for the MacBooks and the Macs of the future.
Well, yeah, because they talk about the AI capabilities. I mean, it's got six, I think 16 NPUs. That's just in the base M4. So you can imagine what the Pro Max and maybe Ultra ones might include as far as those neural processors and how they might tie into all of this stuff. But at this point we've got these neural processors going back to, oh boy, I think well the original M1. But even before that, in the iPhone and iPad, using the A13, A14 processors, they had those neural cores in them too. So all of this AI stuff, whatever Apple's going to announce, some of it may go really far back in terms of their models because they've got these cores on the devices ready to go.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Speaking of which,
Yes.
so the thing I was going to mention this week, we just finished a TV series on Amazon Prime. It's technically Acorn, the one of the two British services.
Yeah, I have
I've
Acorn
mentioned
too.
before how
Yeah.
often we end up finding ourselves looking at some of the British cop shows and so forth and really enjoying them. This was one. Hinterland is what it's called. It's a crime series that's set in Wales. It's a classic, what I call murder du jour, right? Every episode there's a murder. But there are some interesting story arcs. There's one that really spans pretty much, you get hints of it in the very first episode, and it doesn't really resolve until the very last, but it resolves in a very satisfying way. And you're really kind of sort of along for the ride the whole time. Interesting characters, beautiful scenery, enjoyed it quite a bit. So yeah, that's Hinterland on Acorn.
Well, I'll give a shout out to the new Doctor Who episodes that dropped the last couple of days. I'm a lifelong Doctor Who fan. So, but we sometimes go a year or so without episodes. So getting
Oh,
two
cluster.
whole new fresh episodes this week was a real treat. And also they aren't the first episodes. There's three now because there was the Christmas special too that are under the kind of cooperation of BBC and Disney, which means Doctor Who has now graduated in special effects from the traditional,
Oh,
the
interesting.
traditional, let's see what we could figure out how to do it special effects to actual like Marvel movie special effects.
Right.
And it's amazing how quickly you take it for granted too. Like
Absolutely.
watching it, I had to stop at one point and then say, well, wait a minute. There's more than just a monster here. There's like things flying around, they're doing stuff with what's going on in the background. This is like the full bore, like movie treatment special effects. Doctor Who's never had those before. They've gotten better over the years, but
Yeah,
this is the
well,
first time it's been like up to date special effects.
it
It's really
definitely
cool.
started out with the kind word would be cheesy special effects
Yeah.
with back, and to be fair, Star Trek original series level cheesy.
Yes.
But yeah, they've done some interesting stuff this time around. We've seen those episodes already too, and enjoyed them quite a bit. Self-promotion. So this one surprised me. I published an article just last week called Why I Stopped Using Google Search. And in short, it's because too many ads and the search results have basically degraded in quality. I'm not finding what I'm looking for when I use Google. So that's askleo.com/170290. The thing that surprised me about it, though, is especially over on YouTube on the video version of this, is the breadth and the depth of opinion that people are expressing. I've got lots of people who are absolutely did this years ago. What took you so long? To Leo, you're an idiot. Google's fine. Get an ad blocker. There's nothing to worry about here. It's just I find that kind of interesting. The fact that there's some contention around these kinds of positions, I always find entertaining and somewhat educational, to be honest. It's always, to me, it's always kind of surprising what people feel is deeply important. So anyway, that's why I've stopped using Google search. And yeah, by all means, leave a comment. Let me know if you think I'm nuts or if you think I just waited too long.
So I have to ask, what are you using instead?
So I started with DuckDuckGo.
Okay.
Which is fine. And in fact, that's probably what I would be using if I hadn't switched to Kaggi, Kaggi.com. Its claim to fame, so to speak, is that it is a paid search engine. So it's like right now, I think it's like $4 a month or something like that. It's not terribly expensive. And I think there's a deal when you pay for the year, the usual stuff. I'm finding it actually a better search experience overall. And I say that because there are zero ads, right? Uh-huh. It's not part of the revenue model. And I have had immense luck with finding what I'm looking for as the number one search result over and over and over again. And that's just not something that's been happening with Google. It happens sometimes with DuckDuckGo. And I did mention in the article that I avoid Bing on principle. It's probably a fine search engine. And I know that things like DuckDuckGo and even Kaggi may use Bing search engine results. But I just refuse to use it because Microsoft seems so insistent on ramming it down my throat.
Interesting. Yeah, I seem to be maybe a couple months behind you, because what I've done is on one of my computers, my laptop, I've switched the default browser to DuckDuckGo in anticipation of moving completely away from Google and doing a video on it like you did.
Cool. Yep.
And so far, the only data point I've had is sometimes I've been disappointed in the search results of DuckDuckGo. So I've manually gone to Google only to be just equally as disappointed in the search results. So it almost is the kind of thing where my perception was with Google, I was getting the best results. So if I didn't get something good, it just didn't exist, or I had to do a better search term. And with DuckDuckGo, I was not having that assumption. So when I'd see bad results, I'd blame DuckDuckGo, only to go to Google and find out, oh no, Google's been giving me bad results all along. I was just making the assumption that the bad results were actually good results.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm going to have to, I may try yours. I need to find some better way to kind of take notes and really figure out like why I like one over the other. I don't know. Anyway,
one thing that I was criticized on in my comparisons was that I used a product as an example search. I searched for coffee makers. And that actually, you know, yes, you're, especially in Google, you're front loaded with ads for coffee makers that may or may not have relevance to what you actually want. Actually, in fact, on my screen, there weren't any search results on the first page, actually, you know, above the fold, as they say. You actually had to page down before you actually saw true search results. Uh-huh. But some folks have criticized me for using products, and it would be interesting to then also do some searches for less commercial results, maybe some information, maybe some, you know, that kind of stuff. Just to see how they compare. But like I said, in my experience so far using Kaggi, I actually have switched all of my browsers and all of my machines over to it, just because it's giving me the results I want. And ultimately, when it comes to search, that's what I care about.
Cool. All right. Well, my self-promotion is as exciting, you being a Windows guy probably would be totally lost if you tried to install some third-party apps on a Mac, because while some do use installers, and some, of course, you get from the App Store, some do a really weird thing. And it's a thing I've taken for granted because it's been this way on the Mac forever. But when people switch, they find this bizarre, because a lot of times installing an app on a Mac ends up giving you a disk image. And the disk image has this little, like, it shows you the app and it shows you the applications folder and it has an arrow. And to me, it's like, of course I know what to do with that. Well, every Mac that user does. But new Mac users sometimes see that and say, what does this mean?
Okay.
And I didn't realize that until I started noticing a pattern in questions I was getting about it. And questions other people asking. So I did a video explaining this kind of weird culturally Mac installation process called it's just, you know, how many third-party app installs work on a Mac. So
yeah, I would you describe it? I've been using a Mac off and on for years.
That's right. You have your Mac.
Sounds very familiar to me. Yeah. Yeah. But I can see how it's like, okay, what do I do next?
What do I do? What is this? Yeah. Cause it is very weird. If you stop to think about it, it's just that, I mean, literally going back to the 90s, apps have done this on the Mac. So yeah.
Very good.
All right. Yeah.
I think that is another episode wrapped up and hopefully it's recording into the can. Always, thanks for being here, and we will see you all again real soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH220. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.